Thank you. Danny Beresford.
I think it's inevitable that we will retain the split responsibility in some regard. So the question really, I think, is the question that you're asking. I think it can be divided two ways. One, do we have a minimum quantitative measure? And right now, the existing literature doesn't give a specific number. I'm not sure that we need to do that right now. It's obviously left to the auditor's judgment. The second question really is the one that I wanted to address, and the question is: should the qualitative criteria currently included in Section 543.02 be retained or modified? I may not be reading the current literature, but as I printed it out over the weekend, the words are: the auditor should consider, among other things, the materiality of the portion of the financial statements he has audited in comparison to the portion audited by other auditors, the extent of his knowledge of the overall financial statements, and the importance of the components he audited in relation to the enterprise as a whole. All of those sound quantitative and not qualitative. I really don't know what it is that the staff intends with respect to qualitative considerations. It seems to me that, and we get into this a little bit later, I believe, in the discussion, that there may be risk considerations associated with the with less than quantitative materiality type issues. There may be some relatively small equity investment or small consolidated financial statements that somehow or another have some very risky characteristics associated with them that might come into play here. But short of that, I can't really imagine that there would be much in the way of qualitative criteria. But in any event, I really wonder what it was that we have in mind with respect to the second question.
Actually, In that passage that you read from AU 543,
now it works. The extent of the auditor's knowledge, it's sometimes hard to quantify the extent of somebody's knowledge, so it sounds more like a qualitative criteria, and also the relative importance of the portion of the financial statements that the principal auditor assumed responsibility for. Those are were the examples that we had in mind, as opposed to the materiality and more of a quantitative piece in that passage. Just to respond to your question,
I think if I can add to that as well, I think one of the questions that we're asking in this regard is really you really went to the heart of it. Are those considerations sufficient, and are they clear enough as to what those considerations are? So basically, as you said, the auditor, in deciding this question, considers the materiality of the portion of the statements that he or she's audited in comparison with other auditors, considers the extent of his or her knowledge of the overall financial statements, and considers the importance of the components. So is that consideration good enough, or should there be other requirements, whether they be qualitative or quantitative? Should there be minimum procedures that the principal auditor has to perform? Let's take an example where I gave an exaggerated example before, where 95% of the operations were in one country. But let's just are there procedures that the auditor would have to perform to accept responsibility as principal auditor with respect to that operation? But there could be the situation where the operations are really very diverse, and 5% of the business is in the United States, and there's 5% in 19 other locations, such that other auditors, 19 other auditors, are each doing 5%. And so who's the principal auditor in that case when 20 auditors are doing 5%, one is assigned at headquarters? And what are the responsibilities of that person at headquarters if he or she is going to say their principal auditor, in addition to these considerations that you just listed, Denny, should there be other requirements with respect to procedures that he or she should have to perform in gaining an understanding of the work at those other locations before he or she can take on that responsibility? 543 doesn't contain much more, contains really no more than what you just read.
Hal Schroeder.
Question and maybe an observation about this particular question. The question is, have there been any studies that look at the propensity to have audit failures when you have more than one audit firm involved? And does the propensity for audit failure increase or decrease with more firms involved? Have there been any studies along those lines? Because I'm not certain how to answer this question until I have some background, kind of back to the question that was asked early on. Why are we dealing with this in the first place?
I think many of the recent audit failures, they did involve more than one firm, because especially some of the larger engagements, they are performed, as Marty mentioned earlier, by more than one firm. And when we say more than one firm, we mean firms within an audit network. As I said, the principal auditor and the other auditors, there are two different firms, but they may be part of the same network. So just pick up any recent unfortunate event, and the likelihood is there is a large firm that is involved, and there is more than one registered firm within that network that is involved. So I'm not sure whether there's been any studies that targeted that particular issue, but as a matter of fact, this has been happening in the past.
Okay. And as I look through and you ask, you know, should we do it as minimum percentage of revenues or assets, there's no reference to risk. And it seems like there's a fairly easy solution. And I'm looking as an end user, and we look at hundreds of financial statements each year. Why not have a consolidating balance sheet and income statement? If you're going to have multiple audit firms involved, just have a consolidating income balance sheet and income statement, and with each column, label who audited each segment. So we don't have to deal with, well, is the percentage of revenue or assets has nothing to do with risk, and really risk is what we're all talking about here.
Just want to make one thing clear, that we're not only speaking of situations here where the firms are completely unaffiliated. For instance, any of the large big four, for instance, have many different registered firms with the PCAOB. So a big four network firm isn't registered with the PCAOB. It's, whatever, 50 different component or 50 different separately legal organizations around the world are registered with the PCAOB. So in the situation you described, in a multinational audit, you'd have 50 different columns, for instance, I think in that regard. And maybe that's not what you intended.
Yeah, I certainly understand, Marty, what you're saying, but, you know, there are ways to work around that and develop it. But at the end of the day, it would be very helpful to investors to know if there were multiple firms involved in multiple countries, what segments were being audited by the various individual firms or networks of firms.
Yeah, and I think that goes to the heart of a comment made earlier by Professor Cox, who also said that investors, I think this is what you were getting at, that investors want to know, Who did what audit work on any particular engagement? Who were the firms that did that work?
I mean, you know, the problem to the cynical eye is that the accounting firms say to the public, we're one big accounting firm, until they get in court, and then they say we're 50 different accounting firms. So, you know, which story you want to follow should drive a little bit what you want to do with regulation here.
Works again. Lynn Turner.
Marty, I commend you for taking this topic up. You're dealing with the audit reports, and I think in that context, this is an important one to revisit as well. we have seen situations where audits have been called in to question, rightly or wrongly, and you know, Parmalat is the one that probably comes to mind the most, but certainly there have been issues with these. In both times I was at the commission, we had issues with these, and even found situations where with large U.S. companies, a very significant part of the audit, even in excess of 50%, was being done by someone who was not named as primary auditor. So I do think it's a good topic to take up. I think common sense tells you that if you aren't auditing at least half the revenues and half the assets, just common sense tells you you shouldn't be primary auditor. So I do believe that there ought to be a quantitative thing incorporated in the rule that says, hey, if you aren't going to do at least half the revenues and half the assets, you know, how can you represent yourself as really being the primary auditor? I think that's just common sense. I think the other factors that are in there, I would also look to qualitative factors, and I think the things that are in there as far as, you know, the component pieces of the financial statements and the materiality of those as well weigh in. But ultimately, if you can't even say you're doing half of the assets and revenues, I don't understand how you turn around and say you were the primary auditor. With respect to the question that has been raised about how does that apply if you're in network or out of network, if you will, I think if you're in network and you've got the same quality controls, same inspection process running across the network, then I don't think I'd differentiate. I'd view it as one firm. So if one of the large firms could represent that it has the same quality controls, the same inspection process across the board to all its affiliates, I view it as one firm and not separate component pieces for purposes of deciding the auditor. But they got to be able to represent that, and it's got to be factual. And ultimately, that will raise a question about what do you do in situations that we have existing today where you don't have the same inspection process because, as in Europe, the PCAOB is blocked from going into some of those inspections. It's blocked from going into inspections in China. And how should that determine this conclusion about in network or outside of network? Because ultimately, as we've heard around the table already, and as we see in the CFA survey, which I thank Kurt for, investors do want to know who is doing the audit and you know, what pieces of the audit are the different firms doing. And I think that's realistic information for an auditor or for an investor to get, especially since they're voting on the audit committee and they're voting on the auditor quite frequently these days. And that's relevant information so you can make an informed vote. So I would turn around and put some quantitative limits in, keep your qualitative limits, but I'd also then have the disclosure that the investors are asking for clearly about just exactly who is doing the audit and how much. And I actually love consolidating statements as well as Harold. I understand the practical implications of that, but I think ultimately what that runs to is I want to know how much of that balance sheet and what parts of it were audited by who. And I think that's a fair question to turn around and for investors to ask, especially when they're being asked to vote on the auditors and the audit committees as well.
Lynn, thank you for your comments, and you've essentially introduced our next question. I might as well put it on the screen. I mean, there's not enough room just to get both sets on, but part of Lynn's comments related to the second question in developing the criteria for determining whether an auditor may serve as principal auditor, what, if any, consideration should be given to the firm's affiliation with an audit network. So that was part of Lynn's response. Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. I just have a general question, and Lynn may have just answered it, but my My question is, as Barbara Roper indicated on page 6 of your memo, you mentioned that through inspections and investigations that you found some problems here, and so that's why we're here today to talk about this. But my question is, have you therefore concluded that more active enforcement or more aggressive enforcement of the principle underlying the existing standard, that is an insufficient remedy to correct the problems that you identified in your inspection process and in your investigations?
I don't think we're prepared to conclude that. I think there certainly are provisions in 543 that we can use to bring enforcement actions when inappropriate decisions are made to be the principal auditor. But having said that, the characteristics that Denny did bring up before of what the principal auditor thinks about in making that decision, we're certainly asking this group here, is that sufficient, or does the principal auditor have to perform certain procedures at other locations that other auditors are doing work if the principal auditor is only doing some small percentage of the audit? So are the considerations to be principal auditor, are they good enough, or do you need some additional procedures that principal auditor has to perform in order to take on that responsibility? But I don't think we're encumbered in today's literature to enforce if we think the situation is egregious, if that's responsive to your question.
Jim Schnarr.
In terms of looking at the issue, I think one of the things that you need to define is where is the principal order? What is the principal order? Is it at the network level? Is it at the firm level? Or is it at essentially the engagement partner level? Because depending on how you define that, I think it'll dictate the answers to some of the questions that you're asking. From my perspective, in terms of the first question, first of all, I would start with almost the engagement level, if you want, engagement partner level, in terms of the principal auditor, because that individual has to get essentially comfortable with if they're reporting on a consolidated or group accounts, all of the audit work that's done, regardless of whether it's done in network or out of network, and even in terms of within the firm. So if you had a situation where, for example, all of the, if you want to call it, components were in the U.S., the engagement partner still has to have oversight over all of the work that's done by the U.S. people in the various offices. So I think if you start at that level, the criteria becomes, can that individual or the engagement team get sufficient audit evidence with respect to all of the audit work that's done, if you want to call it, outside of the immediate engagement team, whether it be in another office within the U.S., within another firm within the network, or with a firm outside of the network. And so I wouldn't have a quantitative test. I think the key would be the ability to obtain sufficient audit evidence, which would involve the types of things that ISO 600 has, which includes being involved in the risk assessment, in the planning, and then the actual oversight of the actual audit procedures and the findings from the audit. And that way, going to your second question, you might be able, because you have within network or within firm, you have certain quality control procedures and certain audit methodologies. It may allow you or that engagement partner to obtain that evidence, audit evidence, easier because of relying on those systems that are in place and processes in place. But for somebody that's, say, out of the firm or out of the network, you might have to do more work to get comfortable because you don't have that consistent process and you need to get better understanding of the qualifications of the individuals, the competency of the individuals, and then the actual audit procedures that are being performed at that component by that outer network firm.
Thanks, Jim. I think those are really, really good comments and help put this in perspective. But I think some of what you said there gets to the heart of the question that I was raising, and that is, right now, some of the criteria of the decision to be the principal auditor and to make reference or not, the guidance in AU 543 is relatively limited in that regard. You use the expression the auditor, the principal auditor, has to, quote, get comfortable with all of the work that's performed in all of the locations and has, I think you said, quote, oversight over that work. I guess the issue that we'll be addressing here is, what are the procedures that we might require in a revised standard that would, the procedures that the auditor would have to perform to get comfortable, and what are the procedures that the auditor would have to do to have appropriate oversight? So those are good comments, and I think you're saying that the auditor has to get comfortable, but translating that, I think, into a standard with respect to particular requirements that the auditor has to do, I think the things that we're thinking about now. By the way, one other comment was made, which is why I just moved this a little bit closer to me, that for some reason on the webcast it was mentioned that it's, even though we seem to be able to hear ourselves all right here, the more we speak into the speak right into the microphone would help the webcast a little better. Thanks.
I might just call on some people not in the same order in which the 10 cards were raised, just to sort of to perhaps get the auditor's perspective on some of these issues now. So, Sam Ranzilla, please.
Well, let me give you a couple of observations. First, to correct a comment, I don't recall who made it, that ISO 600 doesn't have a concept of a principal auditor. That's not correct. ISO 600 does. The first thing you got to do is determine whether you can function as what they call the group auditor. So there's the same determination you have to make as to whether or not you can even begin the engagement as the auditor of record. I have to tell you, I'm a bit confused by the comments that we want to know who's doing the work around the world, but we're going to write a standard that is basically going to have the group auditor take responsibility for the entire audit. So I guess I'm curious what it is that investors believe is informative in knowing that 22 network firms were associated with the engagement, because that's where those are the countries in which this particular company operates, but when in fact the group auditor is the one taking responsibility for all of the work. And we'll get to, Marty, I think was your point earlier, we'll get to how does the group auditor, what procedures are appropriate for a group auditor when there are a component or other auditors involved in the audit. So I guess I'm a little bit confused. If that information is really important to an investor, then maybe we should have a system where there is no principal auditor, that we just have a series of auditors' reports by legal entity, and there is no auditors' report. So I guess I'd like to understand that a little bit better. Going to your question on principal auditors, quantitative versus qualitative, I think the facts show that outside of these sort of Halley's Comet examples of, one really off-beaten example, that 543 works today with respect to who's the principal auditor. The fact that the auditing standards don't have quantitative measurements in them, for the auditors associated with public companies, the SEC has quantitative measures that have to be met. So effectively, we already have quantitative measures for the auditors of public companies. And on the second question, I think it's the same criteria that one looks at in determining whether you can serve as a principal auditor when the majority of the work's being done by members of your audit network. Principally, it's the same thing. It's just you've got a lot better insight into network firms than you do out of network firms.
Sam raised a couple of questions about the sort of investor expectations as to the information about who does the audit. Before I move on to the next person on my list, anybody wants to respond to that? Kurt?
Sam, we'll talk more about this when we look at the survey results this afternoon, but there's a question in there specifically that gets at whether investors want more information about the network, whether or not it's a shared responsibility or a shared liability, however you want to term that, that information, and Harold and Professor Cox both alluded to that, that it's important for investors to know the identity and the allocation of the responsibilities, even though there's a principal auditor involved.
Those are the allocation of responsibility. If the group auditor signs off on the consolidated group audit without making reference to any other audit firm, they have taken responsibility for all the audit work that's been done. That's the part where I appreciate the interest in knowing what firms might be involved, but it's the allocation of responsibility piece when a group auditor says, you know, I've audited these financial statements, and that's all that it refers to.
Well, I understand, but the survey suggests that whether or not there's a shared responsibility, information about the network of auditors is useful to the investor.
Thank you. There is a barricade of 10 cards on this side. I got to do something with that. I'm sorry. Oh, Hal wanted to. Okay. I'm sorry.
One of the first questions I ask my team of analysts when we're dealing with a valuation issue or reserving issue is, who's the auditor? Because what we've seen is, over time, trends and patterns as to who's more conservative or takes a particular view of an accounting or reserving issue. And we're also having conversations with the CFOs and CEOs and company management. So we get a mosaic, if you will, of all the different issues and views and points of view and positions. So I think that would be very helpful for us as investors to be able to say, okay, go back to my consolidated balance sheet. Here's how it all fits together. And my concern is with this particular company, this asset, it's being audited by this particular firm who historically has leaned in one direction or another. That, to me, is a very valuable piece of information. I understand the issue of networks and all the different firms that make up a single network. And if the lead accounting firm in that network is going to take responsibility, that's good enough for me, assuming that they've got the wherewithal to stand behind that.
Thanks. Mary Moore, please.
I just wanted to add to that. I think that from the investor's perspective, I think I agree with Harold and also what Lynn was saying. I think that a part of it, though, is sort of to the root of, as you find out about the audit firms and the network of the different audit firms, maybe we want to talk about audit firm governance. And I'm really thinking that maybe there should be something like that's been similar to those proposed by FRC on some kind of code that would identify, at least provide to investors, are those minimum measurements being carried out through all the different firms in the audit network.
Thank you. Barbara Roper.
Yeah, I'm still back on the original question, which is I would be nervous about an approach that went too much toward a sort of strict quantitative measure in making this decision for a couple of reasons. I kind of doubt that most of the decisions about whether you can serve as the principal auditor are so black and white that they lend themselves to being clearly defined in some kind of rule, and that if we set a rule, it's likely to be at such a high level that it's not necessarily meaningful, and that then people will comply with the rule rather than complying with the principle, which has been articulated well by other people here. So while I think it's appropriate to look at, you know, whether there are some outside limits where things, you know, are clearly beyond the pale, the real issue goes back to, I think, for me at least, to what Jeff Mahoney was saying earlier, is what you have enforceable? And if it is, then let's enforce it, and that will provide a guidance of its own type for what kind of, how robust the procedures need to be about making these kind of determinations. Then quickly on the issue of information that investors might want, one of the things that I think investors might want is to know, not even so much who, in some cases it may matter who, but how much of the work was, you know, some greater clarity about how much of the work was done elsewhere, other than by the principal auditor, and in my case at least, how many of those firms are not subject to to inspection by PCAOB? You know, how much of the work is being done by audit firms that aren't currently subject to inspection?
Thank you. Wayne Collins?
Thanks. Yeah, there seems to be at least some confusion, at least in my mind, during some of this discussion as to we're talking about the auditor's role on the engagement and how the audit's being conducted or what's being reported. And I wanted to put the reporting matter on the side and just look at the focus of the rule, I believe, is that somebody needs to take some kind of overall responsibility for the engagement. Yes, there may be some reporting division, but if nobody takes the overall responsibility in terms of assessing what the risk of material misstatement is and educating that particular audit team as to what the risks are in various aspects around the world, discussing it with the foreign engagement teams as to how they dealt with the risks, then something could fall through the cracks. So I think there needs to be a principal auditor from the overall responsibility standpoint, and from the quantitative question, I believe, and I agree with Barbara, there's probably too much variation in individual scenarios to come up with a number. And even the example that Marty came up with is certainly an indication that, yes, there are those things that can happen where any one location is no more than 5, 10, 15, or 20% of the total. So you really can have an overall number as to what that audit team did completely. So they need to get involved with understanding what's going on in the rest of the world, even within their own network.
Thank you, Wayne. Doug Anderson.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment briefly on the quantitative versus qualitative. We got to not lose sight of the overall objective is the risk of material misstatement of the financials. And not every revenue dollar has the same risk. Not every asset dollar has the same risk. I think it would be inappropriate and wrong-sighted to try to do absolute quantitative measures, because what you're really trying to get at is risk, not dollars. You're looking for risk of material misstatement. And so trying to write something in that says a majority based on assets or revenues I think would be wrong. What you need to do is provide guidance to say we're focusing on the real risk of material misstatement, and measure it that way, not try to measure it on dollars alone.
Thank you. Doug Carmichael.
I'm not aware of any system. Getting back to an old question, I'm not aware of any systematic study done on liability. As Lynn mentioned, in recent times, Parmalat was one where the divided responsibility facilitated the fraud. Another major one is equity funding, which some of you may remember. But it is still probably the most massive fraud, although the dollars have been eclipsed. But the fraud was definitely facilitated by the division of responsibility and probably would have been detected without the divided responsibility. In recent times, Sendant was another instance where there was divided responsibility. Overall, this is a very difficult area. I think what we struggle with is that the real criterion for the principal auditor is a depth of knowledge extending across the audited entity. And it's very difficult to prescribe procedures that would achieve that. And so I encourage you to focus instead on the objectives that have to be achieved by the auditor taking over all responsibility, and just make those absolute requirements and leave it up to the auditor to figure it out. If the objective hasn't been achieved, then they don't meet the standard.
Thank you. Arch?
Thank you. Some of this probably be repeating some other comments, but with respect to the quantitative criteria, I really don't think you can have bright lines in this area. Decisions like these require a tremendous amount of judgment, and when you're talking about multiple components of a group, the management, the knowledge of the overall organization, many, many decisions have to come into play in making a decision as to whether or not you can serve as the principal auditor, group auditor, whatever term you want to use. And so I don't see bright lines as a possibility here. I think what Doug alluded to this, it really is a situation where if you make that decision, then your work has to support that judgment that was made. And the documentation needs the support that you have been able to take that overall responsibility. With respect to other auditors that might be involved, currently the situation is if you are referring to another auditor in an SEC filing, that other auditor's report's included. So the investors have that understanding and knowledge. And I think that piece of it, if you have determined that you either will not or cannot take responsibility, then I think it quite honestly could be construed to be misleading to not include the fact that your report is based on the report of another auditor.
Galen Hansen, please.
I think that was that last comment. You have to have the multiple audit reports if you're going to have a principal and other auditors. And I think Professor Cox, your earlier comment said you wouldn't necessarily know that. That's allowed on a private audit, but not on an SEC reporting engagement. I wanted to go back to what Sam said about principal. Auditor, not in the ICE, not being part of ICE, and it's just called something different. But I think the distinction, based on what I'm reading here in the briefing paper, is that you only have one audit report. You don't have these multiple audit reports like we have in the United States. So effectively, you don't have a principal subsidiary auditor. You might operationally, but somebody has to be responsible for reviewing all that work in just one report. Am I wrong about that, Sam?
Well, I think we've jumped, quite frankly, right to divided responsibility issue from principal auditor, which is like four steps. You know, we started at step four in this discussion when your questions are really teeing up step one. I mean, you don't have to worry about divided responsibility if you can't be the principal auditor. So if you can't get over the first hurdle, you don't have to worry about the fourth hurdle. You're already out of the race. As it relates to the divided responsibility, you're correct. ISO 600 doesn't have a concept of divided responsibility, but it does have the concept of a group auditor. So you still have to get over, under ISO 600, whether you can be the group auditor, regardless of how you might answer step four, which is, am I going to divide responsibility? But I think to characterize, and I think the briefing paper makes reference to this, that this is some pervasive issue in the U.S. reporting model where there's divided responsibility running, you know, amok. I think your own statistics reveal that it's very rarely used in practice, and as I recall your statistics, the most significant divided responsibility situations are when you have an equity method investee. Even under today, where under the U.S. there's no restriction on dividing responsibility, very little divided responsibility is occurring. As at least that's how I understood the statistics in the briefing paper. And you know, quite frankly, this issue of equity method investments is one that the ISA, I believe, has a working group looking at, because there are some implementation issues with the concept of no divided responsibility and equity method investments. And the other issue that we'll deal with here in the U.S. is more variable interest entities coming up on balance sheet, and whether or not that will create some issues with respect to being able to take responsibility for the work and getting all the access that you need.
If I could continue. Thank you. But it seems to me that in order to finish up on question number two, in this entire area, somehow what a network is, in and out of network, and these relationships and affiliations, one of the first steps that somebody should need to be doing is defining exactly what a network is. And I know that the international IFAC has a definition. The Professional Ethics Executive Committee of the AICPA has been working on a standard to define what a network firm is. And there's a number of different criteria, and most of them have to do with control. For example, whether they're using the same name, whether they have the same quality control system, sharing of costs of people, sharing of profits, all of those things. That might be a starting place to try to get your hands around exactly what is a network firm, and can it be something that you could look to try to pull some of this together, instead of because we all have a different idea of what a network is, but can you define it in some way?
I just wanted to introduce the next question, and please keep your tent cards up, those who want to continue to comment. It seems like our discussion, we've got the lay of the land as far as who the principal auditors are and what the issues are with those first hurdles, as Sam characterized them. But it seems like now we start to talk a little bit more about the procedures that should be performed, and therefore the next question is relates to the requirements for the principal auditor, whether or not the principal auditor refers to the work of the other auditor. So the question is, what information about qualifications of the other auditor should a new standard require the principal auditor to obtain, and how should the qualifications be evaluated? Wayne Carnell.
Thank you. Actually, I just want to share a few observations from my experience at the SEC, and where we do see some issues. And Marty actually alluded to by his example, and perhaps many people thought this was just a rare occasion, but that's a situation where you have a U.S. firm, or sometimes a Canadian firm, signing the financial statements of a company where about 100%, not 95%, 100% of the operations are in the People's Republic of China. You look at the size of the firm, you look at the staff involved, and you question whether any of those people on staff can speak Mandarin or Cantonese. And what we frequently find is that there's a variety of different situations, but frequently they will hire another firm in China, or it might be individuals that are doing the underlying work. But again, the firm, the opinion is signed by a U.S. firm, generally a very small firm, and it becomes the issue is who is the principal auditor? The person is assuming full responsibility that is signing the opinion, but I think it raises questions as who is doing the underlying audit work. And these are not rare situations. It involves hundreds of smaller companies with substantially all of their operations in the People's Republic of China. So I think it is an issue that is very real, at least from my perspective. Another situation that we have seen that is not quite anywhere near as common, but it's an interesting issue when you get to the division of responsibility, and I think somebody alluded to that the SEC has quantified percentages, and we have had a long-standing practice, and I'll emphasize practice, not a rule, that does basically say that the principal auditor has to audit at least 50% of revenues and assets. And that's really based on the assumption that there's another auditor's report in the filing. That's how we would make that analysis. If one auditor is actually relying on the work of another auditor but is assuming responsibility and is not making reference, we would not have that information. But when we have seen some situations where you have different firms involved and one auditor is referring to the audit of another firm and they audited a subsidiary, sometimes the financial statements of that subsidiary are prepared on a different basis of accounting. And one of the things we've always emphasized is, well, who's responsible for the conversion from, let's say, IFRS or Mexican GAAP or Brazilian GAAP to U.S. GAAP? And we have actually tried to address that issue through this reporting, saying somebody has to take affirmative responsibility for that conversion. But I also view that as part of this issue in terms of looking at the division of responsibility, that there's frequently situations where there's different bases of reporting. So those are just some of the problems that we have seen.
Thank you. Jim Dolgan.
Thank you. I know in the briefing materials you refer to the IAASB and the ASB work specifically on group audits. In fact, they have a proposed SAS on group audits. I just think that we'd like to encourage you to spend some time in the conversation about the existing proposed SAS from the ASB and the work they've done, the due process that they've done to develop their SAS when you're considering your proposed standard, and particularly pay attention to the additional requirements or additional standards that you would incorporate above and beyond what is already out there and exposed when you're doing your writing. Go ahead, Marty.
Thanks for that comment. We appreciate that point. And we are doing that. And we've indicated that in our standard setting, we're considering the work of other standard setters. And in our most recent standards that we've issued, and even proposed standards, we've included an appendix which indicates how our proposal or how our standard differs from that of other standard setters and why we thought it was appropriate for that to differ. So that we're doing that in the proposal as well, so commenters have the ability to look at that and say, was your basis for differing good enough or not, or at least to have a view on that. But we're certainly considering the work that was done on ISO 600 and the work that the Auditing Standards Board is doing as well. Thank you.
Gary Kaburek.
Thank you. And let me begin by saying I don't know if this is an important project or enough for the board to actually pursue to update AU 543, but if you do, let me give you some observations, having listened to this, how I would go about doing it, or at least suggest things you should consider. The first thing, I think you need to separate what do the shareholders need to be advised of or to hear or be communicated with versus what does the audit committee need to be involved with in these decisions. You've got a project on audit committee communications. I don't know if this is in the scope of it or not, but if it's not, I would suggest it probably should be, because you can have situations where the primary firm lays off the work and the audit committee doesn't even know about it. I think they should know about it. Again, I'm talking about outside of your group network in it. And perhaps the requirement could be, especially if you refer to the other firm in your report, is that from time to time the audit committee has to meet with that other firm. Again, it's something to consider as you proceed on this project. I think, moving to another subject, I think at least for multinational companies, you need to recognize that when you're in perhaps operating in 100 to 150 countries, that some part of the audit is very likely going to be done not by the parent company's primary auditor. And I would suggest or recommend that in any standard you make some de minimis exception or immateriality exception in there, or an exception for when situations are expected to be temporary. So you have an acquisition mid-year and you're going to see it through, with other auditor and so on. So, again, you don't want to put a big bureaucratic procedure around here for something that's not all that significant but nonetheless does exist. I can tell you, personally, I like the ISO 600 thing about not permitting reference to the other auditors. And that's just personal. My observation would be, if your signing is sole responsibility, it seems to me human nature being what it is you'll take more interest or more due care in terms of the overall report. If you've got two firms or more than that in there, the shared responsibility also, I think, diminishes responsibility as well. So it's just an observation. Again, I think it's worth exploring, should we go the ISA 600 approach where you cannot, under any circumstances, make reference to other auditors' work. Again, I'm not saying what the conclusion should be, but I think it's worth kicking it around because I do think you'll get a better quality product if there's no dilution of responsibility. I think on the quantitative versus qualitative tests, I think no matter where you go, qualitative is still going to be a part of the decision mix. I would be very careful about relying on bright lines in there. And again, even if bright lines could work, numbers change over time and business units increase or decrease in relative importance. So you don't want to have like the old FIN 46 thing where one period might be consolidated, another period you're not, such that audit firms are in and out, depending on mathematical measures. But if you do mathematical measures, I think it can't be a spot estimate. I think it's got to be an average over time, either historical or projected or something like that. It just can't be a narrow measurement period. And I do think equity method investees are a special case because you don't control them in the normal sense. And I would tell you, in our company, we've got an extremely material equity method investee. Doesn't rise to the 20% test under the SEC's reporting rules, but there's billions of dollars involved. We have two big four firms involved. It works fine from our point of view. We don't make reference to the auditor, the equity method investee, but from our experience, it works fine. And I'll just close with a comment from my prior life when I was in public accounting. We had a competitive situation where a very small firm got a large piece of government bid work, and what they in effect did was subcontracted out about 95% of the staff work to one of the big eight firms at the time and took responsibility for it. So again, is subcontracting the work out to the staff and the seniors and your manager reviewing the work, should something like that be in scope or not? I'll stop at that.